pools, which are set to open Memorial Day weekend. If the Parks Department can't hire enough staff to open and operate all operable pools, the city will select locations to open based on historical attendance, equal representation, and geographical distribution. Support this newscast and this station now by becoming a member at kpft.org. And thanks for tuning in to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Looking out a dirty old window, down below the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why.
Welcome to Growing Up in America here on 90.1 KPFT Pacifica Radio. This is a discussion on our children, public policy, and how we do as a city and community when it comes to taking care of all of our children. Growing Up in America is a production of Children at Risk, the voice of Texas children. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to research, public policy, law, and collaborative action on behalf of all Texas youth. We fill each week with the same 60 minutes of lively discussions on the children of Texas with different experts on the quality of life. Of course, we'll have our regular segment, Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, and Data of the Day. And I am joined here, I didn't say my name, but Claire, once again, with Linda. Linda, how are you today?
Hi, I'm doing great, Claire. Good to be with you today.
You know, we are kicking it as co-hosts. And our teaser number today is 154 million. Do you have any guesses?
None. What do you think?
That is 1/8 of how much Texas is about to invest in public schools.
Or bilingual education.
Yeah, or bilingual education. It should be $154 billion for Texas.
Right.
Exactly.
So fingers crossed, we'll see if that's coming up. But we have, of course, a robust lineup of guests. We have joining us around different topics, specifically looking a lot from the immigrant lens in Texas. And so we're excited. We're going to have a short music break and then have Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down. All right, so we have Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, and this week is vending machines in schools. So Linda, I will let you touch in on what your thoughts are.
You know, I'm a big fan of snacks, but like the concern is Cheetos and all of this. But like if you can have healthy, like fruity preservative snacks and almonds and things like that, I think that's a great thing for kids. And I know I always have an afternoon slump, so it's always good to get some support, right?
Yeah, I was a victim of the teacher lounge vending machine. I think I spent $154 million on that machine. But I remember a lot of students, it would cause issues. They would have to unplug them, as I'm sure many schools, because it can't interfere with school lunch and that purchasing model. And so we'd always have to stop students. And then we also had an issue, it was plugged back in, but they would be leaving class to grab snacks. And I don't know, I always went back and forth because if someone's hungry and it's right by the restroom and they grab something to come back, there is a pro and con, especially with beverages. But I agree, sometimes the vending machine would have the energy or high sugar drinks and it would not be promoting any healthy habits and just be more of a crutch to the students than a positive thing. But I'm still pro and thumbs up it just because students are learning best when they're awake, slept, and hungry, or not hungry. So
Exactly. Not hungry kids are always a great thing, especially after PE.
Right. And as a teacher that fell to the pizza reward, it got very expensive. I was the meme of getting the half cut pizza slice from Little Caesars because of how much those pizzas started to cost. So I'm pro vending machines at adequate times with just responsibility. But again, I was in high school, so a very, very niche opinion.
Mm. And I mean, good point, though. I don't know of any like healthy beverages in other than water. What I don't even know what other options there are. So
no, even the juices can be a lot. But I think we're both thumbs up vending machines with the responsibility.
Healthy caveats.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, we are going to have a short break, and then right after, we'll have our first guest.
I'm thrilled to welcome David Saldana, the Director of Business Development at the Social and Health Research Center at Bienestar en Lima. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Thank you, Linda. Claire, thank you. I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to speak on just exactly what we do. We are a nonprofit as well at the Social and Health Research Center. So how do we want to start this?
What specific programs or initiatives does Bienestar and the NEMA Project offer to help address these health concerns among Latino children?
Well, the Social and Health Research Center is a research center that conducts large clinical trials. We've conducted the largest NIH trials ever in elementary and in middle schools. Those are $5 and $11 million respectively. We were able to lower blood sugars and create better insulin sensitivity for these children, waist circumference, increase their fiber intake, their dietary fiber intake, and increase their cardiorespiratory fitness. At this time, we are involved in the largest health and human services trial for four-year-olds in the Rio Grande Valley. These children are among the most obese children in the world. They're hypertensive, pre-diabetic. Some are diabetic, and we are down there to intervene with the Bienestar NEMA coordinated school health program and see what kind of an impact we are making. Well, we are midstream, and we were just published in the Journal of School Health, and we were able to increase these children's cardiorespiratory fitness by 53% compared to 23% in the control. So we are curriculum designers. And so we have designed Bienestar NEMA more than two decades ago with the help of parents, teachers, of course, teachers, it has to be teachers, university professors, and medical doctors.
David, I know we are coming on the cusp of the vending machine conversation, yes. But with that options in school, I know a lot of teachers myself who are very passionate on school lunch and school lunch options, understanding budget restrictions, but also even the healthiest options sometimes aren't the best for students. Where and how do you address that education or in the curriculum? What do you encourage students to kind of lean towards when it comes to options, both inside and outside of the school buildings?
Well, first of all, we are teaching these children what is a healthy choice, first of all. We're not actually teaching them about how many calories something is, although that is in the curriculum, but it is to distinguish what is healthy and what isn't. These children in the elementaries can read labels, and they will say in Spanish to their parents, "Mira, mamá, este cereal tiene mucho azúcar." So they are teaching the parents. So coordinated school health, which is the schools is the environment of which where we work, we feel is the best place to have those public health messages for a good amount of time, 187 days a year, you know, as a teacher, as a former teacher, you know that. And so hopefully we can have them preschool through eighth grade, because that's where kindergarten, I mean, that's where coordinated school health is mandated between that time.
I mean, I'm curious to know, what do you think? All right, thumbs up, thumbs down on vending machines.
Well, okay, I worked in high school as a health teacher and a cross country coach. You know, children or students, if they can make healthy choices, well, let's put it this way. Water, right? Water. Who would have thought that we'd pay so much for water? But people are choosing water now. Even though we are a more sedentary, living a more sedentary lifestyle, even with teenagers. Just a second. They are making this young generation is thinking about it more. They I feel like they are more compassionate. I'm an old goat. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and it's a in some ways it's a kinder, gentler, and they are thinking about things. So I think that having a roadmap, which is what the Bienestar Anima curriculum does, can help them achieve that even better, make those healthy choices.
Right. Rather than strip them of options, let's educate them so they can make
Yes.
those choices.
Yes.
Awesome. David, I think you're echoing a lot that they're kinder. I feel like they get a hard rep, this generation, especially in cancel culture. So I'm glad that you're echoing their knowledge and their champion for each other. When we talk about healthy habits outside of just or in nutrition to start off, we hear a lot about food deserts, and sometimes it's the only option. Or it feels like to some families, and what is echoed is the option isn't healthy because of where they live, their zip code, or just the affordability. How, what are effective methods you've seen with curriculum or outside of curriculum to counteract that? And how effective do you think school and community gardens are as a response?
School and community gardens are an appropriate and really needed and are utilized. So in San Antonio, Texas, one of the examples I use is Southside Independent School District. It's on the far south end of Bexar County. When you talk about food deserts, broadband deserts, food insecurity, they have it all. Transportation is hard, 20 miles to reach a grocery store. So you are seeing four-year-olds come in with their lunches with Takis, Snickers, and a fruit juice. And so some of the things that the schools are doing is to have a shared table. Are you familiar with the shared table? And because before, well, first of all, in free reduced lunch, the cafeteria cashier is saying, in this case, mijo, go ahead and get a vegetable and a fruit, so we can get basically so that you know so the schools know that they can get reimbursed for that lunch. If they don't do that, they lose money. So they learned through experience when they were throwing away the USDA policies of fruit and throwing them in the trash. They started wrapping the fruit, and they started putting it, you know, putting food where it was not touched by other human hands. And so the students, if they didn't want it, they were educated on it, they didn't want that there's a table that you can put it there. And before the end of the day, they are telling me, and I just attended a parent symposium last week, that food is gone. So there is a big need. These families in those underserved areas, they are food insecure. So
Yeah. I
that's
love that you highlighted. Yeah, I love that you highlighted that. I remember now echoing kinder generation, we had almost an unspoken, the students would naturally, if they weren't eating something, I mean, they were putting it on top of the trash can, so they probably could use a table to put it on.
Yeah.
But they would tell me like, oh, miss, I just got it from over there. It just is like this unspoken community of practice. What are some other contributing factors you see to general health in these areas aside from the curriculum or aside from just nutrition and food that help build in the curriculum?
Well, I think, are you saying contributing to good health or to reduce
Right.
the food insecurity? I think the food banks, of course, in San Antonio, it's big. It's a And they do an amazing job. And I'm not sure how it is in Houston, but I'm sure there's a huge need in that. How do you see? I'm a little ignorant about the Houston area of that food bank. How does that work?
Yeah, so I believe if not the largest, it's either the largest or the fifth largest, which is a jump, but something else is the fifth largest food bank in the country. And I know that their director has mentioned that he's gone across the world to really talk about food insecurity and access. And so we've seen a large chunk of the community rely on that, and something that's exciting and empowering about food banks that I've learned more as I get older and learn more about systems is how much they advocate to try to work themselves out of a job so that people have access in our systems to food and there isn't as much insecurity. And that, of course, trickles into housing stability and other systems that they need support with first. But yeah,
I
I also
agree.
wonder too, thinking of, we had students as well that would show up with a Snickers, Takis, and soda. And I would hear from some schools, especially in younger grades, that they wouldn't allow parents to send students with certain foods. What is your opinion on that when schools try to regulate the elementary schools and what parents can pack for lunches? Oh, you muted yourself.
This is precisely the reason you need a curriculum like Bienestar, first of all, because with low income, with low SES, you have low health literacy. They don't know. They want to know. And the children are getting the education that through this program, and they are teaching the parent. Now, the parents obviously have the buying power, you know. So I think more education is would change that substantially. I think that they should still be allowed to bring something in. This is what you have to meet this population where they're at. And then from there, so to speak, coach them up, you know, through the programs. And the programs have been effective, and it is mandated by law in the state of Texas that coordinated school health program must be adopted by, you know, must adopt a TEA approved coordinated school health program. Every public school has to have that. And you know, I mean, it was a 40-year rise of chronic disease in youth. So, you know, we have to intervene and do something, and that's where we come in. I think there's what's happening. We're in the environment that we work. There's lots of the barriers that are being produced now is the stripping of funding of education in PE and health. And that hurts because those children are learning not only the nutritional how to choose, but also understanding the relationship of having to move within that whole spectrum of health. So this is the you know, so some of those policies at the state level that are directly related to the environments we work in, you know, hurt that mission.
Yeah, of course. And I know our time is short, but we have a lot of parents that tune in. So for any parents listening that might not have this equipped access with their students in schools, what is something that you would like to leave them with that's an often misconception that you heard?
A misconception about what
Oh, so something that a parent listening that might not be equipped with a curriculum similar to
okay.
yours, that they might have a misconception you'd like to bust, or just in general, a piece you'd like to note about their child's health.
I think what's first ask about your coordinated school health program in the school. Ask about it. And then look at and see what evidence it is that it's not that it's something that meets your needs. The other thing is it has four arms. You have health literacy within the school, you have the PE component, you have child nutrition services, and then the parent. That parent component is very, very important. What parents can do is get involved with their kids. Sweet, that parent component is really there to transform the social environment. So with allowing your children to help prepare the foods, set the table, do those kinds of things, but also take time to go and do an activity. Walking, simple thing, get the whole family walking. It bonds the family and you get healthier.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you so much for all that you do and for advocating for, like you said, imperative school programs that are the first sometimes to see those budget cuts. And we would love to have you back on and thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Claire. Thank you
Thank
so
you,
much.
David.
Thank you, Linda.
Awesome. We, after the break, will be joined by Chelsea Kramer with the American Immigration Council.
Ey, ey, y aprovechame hoy, que mañana me voy, y no sé cuándo vuelvo, si en tus ojos me pierdo. Y aprovechame hoy, que mañana me voy, y no sé cuándo vuelvo, si en tus ojos me
pierdo. On with us now, we have Chelsea Kramer with the American Immigration Council to talk a little bit about the economic contribution of immigration. Chelsea, how are you today?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be here today. As a native Houstonian, it's always excited to be able to talk to other Houstonians and Texans.
Awesome. Are you currently in Houston or?
I am. I am in the Houston metro. So I actually live in the Seabrook area. I spent a lot of time in North Houston prior to moving down here about 2 years ago to the Seabrook area. And that's where I'm at today in my home office.
Well, awesome. We are excited to chat and dig into a little bit of recent data that has come out from the AIC. But can you first, for our listeners, give a 10,000 foot over the ground view of what AIC does?
Yeah, I'd love to. So the American Immigration Council, we're a national organization that is bipartisan. We were actually started in 1987, so right around the time that we last had some big immigration policy actually passed through Congress. But the American Immigration Council, at our root, we're a research and advocacy organization, and we're really working to help modernize our immigration policies in a way that is not only humane and fair, but also true to America's core values. And I know with Houston and Texas being disproportionately impacted by anything that happens in the immigration space. And that's why Texas is our ground zero. And so I'm here as the Texas organizer and also lead our Texas Business Coalition, Texans for Economic Growth, which has over 160 business leaders from across the state, many of which you know that are right here in the Houston area, who are very active in helping folks understand that immigration is extremely important for our economy and for our workforce and for help keeping vibrant and growing communities.
You know, we were excited to dive into the report that you all helped bring together, New Americans in Houston, which provides a snapshot of the demographic and economic contributions of immigrants in the metro area. Were there any findings there that surprised you?
Yeah, so first, I would always always preface any of these kinds of conversations with always like, I know we're not in a Q&A, but I always ask, and I'll, this will be a rhetorical question for our audience, but how many communities do you think grow without immigrants? And that answer across the board is always zero. And so I wouldn't say this is so surprising because being here in the Houston area, I always see there's such vibrant growth. We have such beautiful, diverse communities with so many different cultures present. And so I'm not surprised by these huge numbers that come out of this report. However, I was surprised to see that we did this report just a few years ago. And so this was just a very recent update. And these numbers have increased quite significantly. So we did this about 2 years ago. And the share of immigrants in the population has already increased by a whole percent by about 1 million residents. And so that's quite the influx of immigrants into our community, which is showing in big numbers when it comes to housing wealth and taxes and those kinds of economic factors that I know business leaders and policymakers really look at when they're trying to figure out how do we keep our economy rolling moving forward.
Yeah. What are some trends that you find that help speak to policymakers or really talk to community stakeholders across the aisle when it comes to this economic contribution?
Yeah, it's always a tricky conversation to have, especially in such a heated election year, when a lot of people, when they're talking about immigration, they're only thinking about the border and what's happening there. And so what we're finding is that when we can actually sit down with policymakers and talk about immigration through an economic lens, that's when their eyes stop glazing over and they go, oh, actually, we do have a bunch of job openings to fill. And so when we're just, if I'm flipping through this report right in front of me and looking and showing that nearly 80,000 local manufacturing jobs here in the city of Houston that would have otherwise been eliminated or had moved elsewhere stayed and were created here in the Houston area. Those are huge numbers, especially when we're looking to revitalize a lot of different communities across the city. And manufacturing is going to play a big role in that, especially moving forward. And then just looking at, like I mentioned earlier, housing wealth is huge because immigrants hold over $130 billion with the B in property value. And that's huge for the city of Houston, huge for our communities, huge for our economy.
You know, this is an election year, and it's, I mean, just following the news, it's always hard to know what could possibly happen, you know, under a Trump administration again. When it comes to like the impact that businesses could sustain possibly from, for example, a huge deportation machine, which Trump is promising on day one of his administration. What do you think more business folks need to understand about that kind of rhetoric and their bottom line in their businesses?
Linda, thank you so much for that question, because that kind of rhetoric is extremely damaging, not only for our economy, for our future, but for the individuals and the families who are living in this space right now. And to give some context there, we have some really interesting stats that I think are important for everyone to be thinking about when they hear some of this very damaging, very anti-immigrant rhetoric that's usually coming from a place of misinformation or very, very incomplete information. And that is that here in the state of Texas, we have here in the state of Texas, we have nearly 1.7 million undocumented immigrants. That's a huge number. You're not deporting that many immigrants, no matter what. And these immigrants, they hold $33.9 billion in total spending power. They pay $4 billion in Texas, and this is all annually. And these are actually really great stats that come from MapTheImpact.org, which is an online tool that we are constantly updating and helping folks understand the impact that immigrants have to their own personal communities, their counties, their states, their different industries. And so definitely suggest that folks go dig into that tool. And we actually saw these stats show up from the Dallas Morning News and the Austin American Statesman from our friends Woody Hunt and Congressman Colin Allred talking about the importance of immigrants. And so that just happened this past weekend. But I bring this up to point out these huge undocumented immigrant numbers here in the state, and especially here in the city, because if we zoom out a little bit and look at the entire country, there are nearly 1 million U.S. citizen children that are living with one undocumented family member in their household. If we zoom in out a little bit further, there are nearly 800,000 U.S. citizen children who have at least one undocumented parent. And so that's 11% of all U.S. citizen children are living with one undocumented immigrant parent. So just think through the lens of a child who might be catching a news report or a soundbite from someone like President Trump, who might be saying some very ugly, nasty things about their own family members, who are hardworking individuals. Again, these folks are many a times are paying taxes. They want to get here and be here legally. Unfortunately, our immigration system, like I mentioned at the top, hasn't been updated since about 1987. So there just are clearly just not enough legal pathways for these hardworking people. And so that is where we start to get into this really nasty area of thinking about how anti-immigrant rhetoric affects families and individuals. In the long term, how is that going to affect policymakers who are going to our state house and thinking, oh, well, we heard the president talking about how terrible immigrants are. What can we do at the state level? And we're already seeing the effects of what that rhetoric can do here in the state under different policies that have passed through the Texas legislature.
Chelsea, I'm glad you mentioned that in almost a seemingly perfect segue. I was going to ask, because we saw in Florida that harmful rhetoric really play deep in policies that were passed in this past year, and hearing a lot of stories of immigrant families moving out of Florida or seeking to leave Florida because of the laws that were passed, or children in those homes possibly being charged with a felony just for living in their home because of the status of family members. What is this rhetoric mean for the larger picture, and what could it mean in Texas if these laws trickle in, especially with our workforce?
Sure. I think the workforce lens is the perfect place to look at that. And we can look at what's been happening in the Houston and Texas areas in the past couple of days. We've had catastrophic flooding that we haven't seen since Hurricane Harvey. Who's going to be rebuilding these communities? Who's going to be rebuilding these homes to get these kids back in school, get their families back to work, rebuilding roads? A lot of times that's immigrants. Here in the Houston area alone, almost 22% of all of our construction workers are immigrants. And that number continues to increase every year. And so if we start getting into a place where immigrants are feeling unsafe in their homes, unsafe in their communities, they're going to start looking elsewhere. They're going to start looking for other communities that have more welcoming policies. States like Utah, a lot of the Midwestern Rust Belt states are really seeing that an opportunity with immigration and saying, hey, how can we revitalize our communities? Let's attract immigrants. Let's integrate them into our society. Let's figure out ways where we can fill workforce gaps with immigrants and make a beautiful fabric of a community. We're not seeing that in Texas as a whole, but there are some really beautiful pockets. I know the city of Dallas has a great, great immigrant welcoming program. The city of Houston worked really, really hard several years ago to publish a welcoming plan that we're hoping under the city's new mayor and administration that we can work together to uplift even further. And so back to your original question on what does this do for workforce? Well, when you make a place unwelcoming, people are going to stop coming. And I know that's what a lot of folks on the fringe would want. They think, oh, well, we don't want immigrants coming to our state. But they're not realizing that this rhetoric affects immigrants at every single level. Think about the Texas Medical Center and all the immigrants that are working there and how important that is for not only the vitality of this entire region, but for your own personal family's health as well. And so immigrants are in every aspect of our lives when it comes to what foods you're eating on your dinner table, where it came from, how affordable housing can be in the Houston region, down to how well our children are being educated with bilingual opportunities to them as well. And so it just comes down to a welcoming community is one that is better for everyone.
Right. Well, I mean, I appreciate your insights always, Chelsea, but you know, here on the border, we always get all the attention, but it's like 5% of the reality. And so I love how your data and perspectives really ground us on everything else that's happening in the country and our economy and our families. So thank you again for joining us, Chelsea. It's been great to hear from you.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It's been a lovely chat.
Thanks, Chelsea. Shortly after the break, we'll have our data of the day. Before the break, it is Pledge Month. So because KPFT is free radio for listeners, we're able to have this platform to have Chelsea, David, Dr. Kulesa join us week by week to really dive into conversations that affect our community and state. And so we want to really emphasize Pledge Week and KPFT Pacifica Radio. If you go to kpft.org, there's a big, beautiful donate button at the top. And there right now are running a ton of prizes and opportunities after your donation to be able to get. I know we've gotten cool mugs in the past, but it really helps amplify voices around Houston. So keep 90.1 on air, keep KPFT running, and go ahead and donate if you're able to. And with that, I will take it to the break before Data of the Day. On with us now, we have Dr. Christopher Kulesa from Rice University. How are you this now sunny Wednesday?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We are well. We are excited to hear about $154 million. Aside from how much you're donating to KPFT today, what does that number mean for Texas?
So today is good news. So the $154 million is how many lives have been saved over the past 50 years due to vaccines. And 101 million of those were infants. This comes from a study that was done as a part of the 50th year anniversary for the World Health Organization's expanded program on immunization. So good news this week.
Yeah, I mean, that's great news. 154 million lives is an insane, especially for 50 years. I believe we always talk about the importance of vaccines, but I just had a conversation recently on it. And so can you emphasize for our listeners again, the social responsibility of vaccines and what it really means just in 1 year out?
Sure. So just very basically, vaccines save lives. Right. And when it comes to just what we've seen in terms of the data over these past 50 years, we have seen a dramatic increase in the survival rates of disease because of the impact of vaccines. So just very basically, a consequence of a program like this, a child born in 2024 has a 40% increased survivability because of our efforts with vaccines. And particularly when it comes to like the measles vaccine, that tends to have one of the biggest impacts. With that being said, unfortunately, we are starting to see a bit of challenges, right? There are certain areas of the United States where parents aren't getting their kids vaccinated, and we're starting to see increases in conditions like measles. And with that, we're seeing an increase of illness. So just with that being said, it is, of course, all the more important for parents to make sure that their children are getting the recommended doses and the recommended vaccines.
Awesome. And I know to our listeners out there, we've talked about this every week, but Dr. Kulesa, if there's one thing you can recommend to parents who are skeptical or just hearing a lot, what are pieces and sources that they can turn to for information?
So I would say that they would definitely be able to turn to sources like, you know, Baker Institute, for example, the Center for Disease Control. Listen to their doctors as well, right? Definitely make sure that they're listening to their pediatricians and just even anecdotally, right? Our families are not suffering from the same kind of conditions that we were, you know, 60, 70 years ago. We don't have the same conversations about having to worry about the impacts of like polio, for example. And why is that? Because vaccines have had such a positive impact on our lives. So I would say definitely, you know, listen to the researchers, listen to your doctor.
Awesome. Well, that is perfect advice. And we are excited and love to have you on, especially when it's a good news day. We look forward to next week. Fingers crossed it is on a good streak with good news.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us.
All right. We are going to have a short break. After the break, we'll be joined by our next guest and have a conversation around exploring bipartisan solutions to immigration.
So happy to welcome Juan Carlos Cerda, the Texas State Director at the American Business Immigration Coalition. Thanks for joining us today, Juan Carlos.
Thank you for inviting me, Linda.
So I'm a big fan. You know, it's election year, which feels like doomsday here in El Paso, Texas. But you're not giving up. Tell us what work is American Business Immigration Coalition working on right now in Congress? Lots of exciting projects that I love reading about.
Yes, it is an important election year, but the work to try to grow our economy continues. The American Business Immigration Coalition, or ABIC, is a bipartisan coalition of more than 1,400 employers and business leaders, and we promote common sense immigration reform. Here in Texas, some of our most notable leaders include Dennis Nixon, the CEO of IBC Bank, Stan Merrick, the CEO of Merrick Construction, and Woody Hunt, the senior chairman of Hunt Companies. And what we are pushing for is a solution for our workforce shortages. Right now, businesses across the country and across our state are struggling to find workers. And at the same time, we have millions of residents who lack work authorization and could fill open jobs. So what we're asking both President Biden and Congress to do is to allow over 1.6 million Texans who lack work authorization to get work authorization so that they can help fill the over 749,000 open jobs that our employers in Texas are struggling to fill.
I think, you know, coming from the border, this is where the dysfunction comes into the conversation, right? Well, you're just handing out free work permits for folks to work. That's why we got to close the border and stop incentivizing people to come. How do you respond to that rhetoric to kind of get to the actual reality of families here in Texas?
Absolutely. There's a difference between what's happening at the border with the migration that is increasing there and the families who are already in the country, already in Texas, who have long resided in our state. There's over 3 million U.S. citizen adults who live in a family that has someone who doesn't have work authorization. These are known as mixed status families. If you look at the Texas residents who lack work authorization, the 1.6 million of them, 64% of them have been in the country at least 10 years. So they're not only far removed in many cases from the border, but in terms of time, they came to this country a long time ago. They've been paying taxes. This population pays over $4 billion in taxes and has a spending power of $33.9 billion. So it's not really their fault anymore that they were able to come to the United States and stay in the United States. In fact, now that they're here, we should allow them to legally work and to contribute to our economy because the workforce shortages are so severe and the need for workers is so immense that anything that has to do with people already here, that should be a priority for our lawmakers. We do agree that the migration issue at the border should be addressed, but we can do both things at the same time. And Congress actually tried to do that this year. Unfortunately, both parties didn't agree. In fact, many conservative lawmakers on the right and many liberal lawmakers on the left, they didn't come to an agreement because there's just too much extremity on these issues.
Right. I mean, you could easily be talking about DACA recipients also right in the state of Texas who are filling critical work shortages also on around the state. I know this is a big week in Congress. Children at Risk is also participating in Note and Comment as Congress, you know, continues to deliberate on whether or not they should save DACA. What insight could you give us there on what's going on in DC when it comes to saving DACA? That's such a critical lifeline for so many families here in Texas.
It is a very important issue. And as a DACA recipient myself, it's a very personal issue to me. Right now, we're facing additional lawsuits or additional litigation due to a lawsuit that originated from the state of Texas against the DACA program, which, as you've explained, helps protect 95,000 individuals here in Texas who came to the country when we were children, who grew up here and attended U.S. schools and are American by any measure. So there's litigation against this program. And recently, a federal court judge ruled that DACA was unconstitutional. We expect the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to make a similar determination, and the case could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court of the United States as soon as 2025. If the court, which has been known to make some very conservative rulings, agrees that DACA is unconstitutional, that could mean that 95,000 Texans who've been living here the majority of their lives could lose their employment. So Congress is speaking about this issue as we speak here now. Yes, you probably saw the Senate judiciary hearing on Dreamers. It's an issue that has to be talked about because not only are DACA recipients at risk of losing their work authorization, but we also have undocumented Dreamers who don't have access to DACA due to them being frozen out of the program due to the court ruling or did not arrive before the 2007 arrival date.
Yeah. You know, so much of what you talk about is just so pragmatic. It makes so much sense. Can we get it done, Juan Carlos? Is there any hope for bipartisan approaches in Congress?
Absolutely. The opportunity for a solution on DACA and potentially on border solutions is right before us. And when there's a new Congress in 2025, and if there is a a Supreme Court ruling on DACA next year, that could be a spark to bring people and to bring lawmakers together on both of these issues. So yes, there is a potential for bipartisan reform, but as we've seen, we can't just wait on Congress to do its job. Sometimes we have to do things administratively that are within the law to allow employers to have the workforce they need and for U.S. citizens' spouses to be reunited and to have access to that work authorization. So that's why we're asking the Biden administration to expand work authorization for the spouses of U.S. citizens. And it's something that the White House is looking closely at and has been publicly reported to be considering doing as soon as June, which is literally next month.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed, and sending you all the good juju. I just always appreciate seeing updates from ABIC. You guys are always on the ground, always mobilizing, and that's a big deal. You know, keeping immigrant families together also means ensuring that parents can work safely in this country without fear of deportation. So thanks again, Juan Carlos. I really appreciate your input today.
Thank you, Linda.
Awesome. After the break, we have our last but not least guest joining us. Before the break, one last time, to hear these conversations and to encourage KPFT to stay running and stay amplifying such powerful and strong community voices. Like Juan Carlos said, that we need to sometimes work faster than Congress. And sometimes that really is just joining the conversation and making sure to bust out myths and spread information. So with that, if you are inclined, you can call 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. Press 1 and donate today.
Well, I'm happy to welcome our next guest, Peter Liberos, a bilingual interventionist at Cypress Fairbanks ISD. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Yes, no, thank you for having me over.
Awesome. Dr. Liberos, we're excited to have this conversation around newcomer students in schools. And I know that you personally are passionate on parent and family engagement. As you heard the end of that conversation and really the essence of today, which is making sure that we protect immigration and we protect the immigrants that live in Texas and across the nation, how do you see kind of these policies bubbling and the harmful rhetoric really from the original Trump administration to now bubbling in between schools and children and families?
So unfortunately, you know, this has affected our community, our immigrant community firsthand, right? And so a lot of times it's created a sense of, you know, additional barriers than going in. They already have so many barriers. So when we talk about the barriers that our immigrant families have, they have socioeconomic barriers, they have cultural barriers, they have language barrier. And now it's, you know, they see our country in itself and our schools as barriers because they see it as a place not of refuge and not of support and help, unfortunately. And we're talking about our public schools. We're not talking about private schools. We're talking about our public schools. And so unfortunately, as I've been interviewing some immigrant families, that sense of, you know, they don't belong inside of a school, they're scared of our schools. Because they are immigrants, because of the rhetoric and what they hear in the news and what's going on with our current administration, our previous administration, and a lot of it transferring over. And because we're in the state of Texas. And so a lot of times then they feel that our families in our schools feel that they don't belong and that this is not a place for them.
I mean, schools are also like a beautiful place, right? Like you can get it right. You can turn it around. You can make kids feel welcome. And your role is kind of a big deal. Explain what a bilingual interventionist does.
So I am very fortunate to work with our bilingual ESL students, primarily our bilingual students from third to fifth grade, and I support them in their reading and their families as well, and the teachers in that capacity. And going back to something you have mentioned is that absolutely public schools have that opportunity, right, to be able to provide those resources, provide those opportunities to those families, and my bilingual students benefit from that, right? And so it's allowing that, you know, our families to have that leverage and that equity possibility, right, to leverage that education for them. Because as I've been interviewing parents, one of the big things that they say is that education is something that they value, something that they embrace in their homes. And so being able to provide that support for that dream and that American dream to become a reality is so important. A lot of times they use the words of, yo quiero que ellos tengan un mejor futuro que yo tuve, right? I want them to have a better future than I had. And so, and that was 100% of the participants that I've interviewed. And so schools, going back to that, have that opportunity to provide that social capital, whether it be through emotional support, through instrumental support, appraisal support, informational support. It's vital for them, right? In order to even receive the quality education that the rest of their peers receive.
I mean, I love the fact that you gave us examples of parent insight. My parents were field workers. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, we came to America so that you could have a better opportunity, just like you're saying. And I just feel like parents are just such an important piece of the puzzle, but culturally, linguistically, they feel disconnected. Yes. What approaches actually make, even they don't even know about TELPAS, right? Like, what is the significance of TELPAS?
Yes, absolutely.
What's working? What's bridging the divide between schools and parents?
That's a great question. And so building that trust, what I've noticed as I've been doing this research, that parents want it. They want to be active. They want to be a part of their child's education. They want to be engaged. They want to be in the campus, actually. But there are so many barriers, right? And there's a lack of trust in the system. And so I think that if schools then start embracing our community, right? They start welcoming them in, allowing their voices to be heard and allowing their voices to have importance and value. That creates a difference, right? And that creates that possibility to then work as a team in order for our parents to have their voices heard. And that would lead to better academic results, right? Because at the end of the day, my child is saying that I care, our teachers care, our admin care, we're all in this together for a common cause, which is our children. And one specific thing that was mentioned a lot through the participants was, in my dissertation study, is that they were talking about parent workshops. We want to know how, we know we have questions about, like you said, TELPAS, right? What is that? How can I support? STAR, what can I do at home to support, right? What resources do I have? And so if we have these parent workshops in their native language at our schools with people that can relate to them, can talk to them, they can ask questions freely in a stress-free environment where not even translation is a thing, right? Because that's even a barrier. A lot of times we said, oh, go ahead and we can translate this, meaning, yes, I can see where that comes from. But a lot of times there's even barriers with that. The embarrassment of raising your hand, having someone translate it, is that even going to come across the way I wanted it to? And just culturally, it's just a lot, right? And so being able to relate to we have staff members, right, and that speak Spanish, that are, you know, aware of our culture. And so being able to bridge that opportunity and allowing these voices to be heard is very important.
Yeah, I love this conversation. And you address two things that I'm glad you did. One, dangerous and dangerous really to schools to make assumptions. I know, especially in lower income communities that I and my peers have taught out, the assumption is parents don't want to be involved. They're too busy, or they're not involved from the jump. And the assumption is just to kind of ice them out or only make the call home when it's negative. And the best response I ever got was when I made positive calls home, or just the initial call home in the beginning of what are your goals for your student and how can we work together, and just really the key importance of that. And then the second thing that I can die on a hill on is access. And I love that you mentioned language access is not simply the only thing sometimes, because there's also a cultural point. I believe you shared the story of when parents show up to schools and sometimes immediately feel iced out because no one speaks their language. There's no opportunity to engage when it could just be they're trying to pick their student up for a doctor's appointment.
Right.
What are ways, what is in our last few minutes, something that you would really suggest schools look at that can bridge those, build those bridges if they have low staff that are able to bridge those language gaps?
Absolutely. Something as simple as just allowing them to come into the building, to allowing them to have that voice and the opportunity to ask questions and to be just frank, right? And to have those honest conversations about how they're feeling and what makes them feel this certain way. Each campus is different, each front office staff, because a lot of times in my interviews, front office staff came a lot in our conversations. Well, they made me feel this way, or there were barriers there. And so, two things that campuses can do is allowing these parents to come in, right? And to be part of, like they have mentioned, parent workshops where we answer these questions, we provide them all of this information. And second, train our staff on how to then, front office staff, teachers, everyone in our school, how do we best provide support and communicate to our immigrant population, right? And so I think that those are two key things that a campus can easily do through professional development, especially now that we're going through the summer, maybe for the start of next school year, of thinking of ways to connect with our community, to involve everyone together, because our immigrant community is only growing. And so how we embrace them is important. And at the end of the day, all our students are Hispanic Americans. They are Americans. They deserve the quality education that any other student needs. And so being able to provide it, whether they're immigrants or not, they are American students. And so they deserve the best access and quality education that we can provide, regardless of their status, regardless of their immigrants.
Yeah, that was the perfect wrap up. Dr. Lebreros, we love to have you on again, and thank you for the work you're doing and the nod to that it takes the whole school and whole staff to really make families feel welcome.
I appreciate it. Thank you all very much, ladies.
Thanks for joining us.
Awesome. And that concludes another wonderful show. Linda, I look forward to co-hosting next week. For all of our listeners to hear these voices again, tune in every Wednesday from 12 to 1. This has been Claire and Linda, and we do this every day for children.
For children.
With a dream, my cardigan. Welcome to the land of fame, excess. Am I gonna fit in? Jumped in the cab, here I am for the first time. Look to my right and I see the Hollywood sign. This is all so crazy. Everybody seems so famous. My tummy's turning and I'm feeling kinda homesick. Too much pressure and I'm nervous. That's when the taxi man turned on the radio. And a Jay-Z song was on. And the Jay-Z song was on. And the Jay-Z song was on. So I put my hands up to play my song. The butterflies fly away. Nodding my head like yeah. Moving my hips like yeah.
you want.